Welcome to the Packet Pushers. We're jumping on the hype train as the last train to nowhere. Today, we are deep diving on Juniper Networks in a sponsored podcast about the self-driving network. Now, you may have noticed that intent-based networking has been a popular topic around here for the last month or two. At its core, the idea that networks should operate themselves is basically what autonomous routing protocols have done for the last 20 years. But really, selecting the single best path is just a fraction of what we call operations. What about reducing the manual configuration or device monitoring or management of the device as a whole thing or the entire network? What about correction or adaptation in case bandwidth gets overloaded? How do I shed load automatically? What about self-defense? Do I self-defend the devices from external attacks, or how do I protect the network from overload or DDoS situations? And how do I configure analysis telemetry on the fly? None of these are things that we do today. But late last year, around about October 2016, Juniper started sharing the idea of self-driving networks with the broad goal, and very aspirational, and I like it a lot, of a zero-touch network. A lofty goal, an ideal perhaps, but really it's about reducing the day-to-day human interaction with your network. Now, before we get started, yes, I know many of you write to me and say, but this doesn't seem relevant to me. But what I want to tell you is, just like any major technology transition, self-driving networks will take some time to arrive. So this is a show about adapting your network strategy over time. This is something that we're all working towards. It's across the entire industry. Anywhere you look, this idea of autonomous self-driving intent is definitely where that's going. Now, with all that said, let's introduce our guest today. Karidi, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Karidi Kompella, CTO for engineering at Juniper Networks.
And well known for a wide range of things.
Yes, mostly MPLS, but I'm trying to get away from that now.
Sure. And also joining us today is Nathan Embry. Nathan, please tell a little bit about yourself.
Hi, guys. Yep, I'm a senior consulting engineer with Juniper. I work on automation and programmability. And I'm slightly less well-known than Karidi.
Okay, as are we all. So let's start with a summary of the Juniper self-driving network. Karidi, let's start with why is it that we always do, or why do we want a self-driving network? What's the fundamental purpose behind this that's driving us in this direction?
Well, I think the starting point is what I like to call these imperatives. There's the economic imperative, there's the security imperative, there's the efficiency imperative. And so the economic imperative is that we have, we focus on the capex of the network, but really the opex is where most of the money goes. And we can make that much more, much leaner, much more efficient. But also, in many cases, we don't respond quickly enough. And usually things in networks don't have to be responded to very quickly. But some things do have to be responded to quickly. And that takes us to the security imperative. What we see with security is, you know, if there's a DDoS attack or if someone's exfiltrating data from your network, you want to figure that out quickly. You want to understand where this is coming from or where this is going, and you want to shut it down. And to do all that quickly is really important. Whereas, you know, if a link fails, you probably have the right protections in place so that you don't have to panic. But if someone's taking that data out of your network, you don't want to respond quickly. Mm. There's also the efficiency imperative, that are we running our networks as efficiently as we can? And again, if we have the right tooling behind us, if we take all of the data that we have in the networks and use it appropriately, we can run the networks hotter, we can be efficient about the use of resources, we can move things around so that people find that their response from the network is much better, their SLAs are met. So these are the things that I think people really want to achieve, and we've tried many different ways. I think self-driving networks will get you there. And I would like to say that I did coin the term self-driving networks on purpose to use the SDN TLA. So people are thinking of SDN and NFV for improving things. Is this too long?
Yeah, no, I got it. I was just laughing because I hadn't noticed that. You had said self-driving network. SDN is the acronym, obviously. Okay, and you did that on purpose, and that just hit me, since so many people have had so much fun with the SDN abbreviation over the last few years.
Well, people also try MPLS DNMV.
Karini, one follow-up point I wanted to ask you about. When you were talking about the economic imperatives, you mentioned that CapEx is actually less of a cost than OpEx. OpEx is the bigger cost and one of the things we're trying to control and could help be controlled under a self-driving network. What are the components of that OpEx? You know, a lot of people think about support costs and personnel costs. Are those the things we're talking about or beyond that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of components. I mean, space and power is definitely a component that's not going to be, impacted greatly by self-driving networks. But personnel, the timeliness of things, when people do something in the networks, there's often human error, and there's a cost associated with that. So, all of those components can be improved. The space and power, not so much.
I wanted to sort of expand on some of the ideas. You in the notes that we've sort of prepared, you talked about the five technology pillars of where we are, where we're going. And I wanted to cover those five pillars that you talked about in a self-driving network. The first one is telemetry. Now, I've talked a lot about analytics and telemetry being the most exciting development in networking over the last 2 years, because seeing what's actually happening in the network is something we've not really had. Like, and when I say seeing in the network, I'm talking about flow state, volume of flows, what users, what's connecting to what. And through that, we can suddenly to do things. So how does telemetry then feed into the self-driving network concept?
So I love to do an analogy with self-driving cars. And of course, all analogies will break down if you take them far enough. But the self-driving car, you have a lot of telemetry on cars. You have the speedometer, you have the tachometer, you have tire pressure gauges, you've got all kinds of stuff. But lately, we started adding more stuff, a radar, a sonar. So the latest one is LiDAR, which is a light-based radar, which will give you a 360 picture of everything around you in real time with a much finer resolution than radar will. And there's this big discussion between the Google self-driving car and the Tesla self-driving car. Should we use stereo cameras or should we use LiDAR? Google uses LiDAR, or I should say Waymo, and Tesla uses stereo cameras. And Uber and Google are in a lawsuit about this. And what that says is we don't necessarily know what telemetry we want until we say why you want it. So if you just want to do visualization, you might get away with less telemetry. But if you want to actually self-drive, this is huge.
So what we're seeing then is an emergence of telemetry technologies that are part of this. So we've seen, all of the Yang models and the gRPC streaming protocols and all that sort of stuff. And that's something that's still emerging, but that's going to enable the self-driving capabilities that we're looking at.
Absolutely. And the fact that this is real time, you're not polling, you're not using SNMP, that, events will come in real time as well. And it sort of drives to the next one, which is the multimodal views, where you cross-correlate telemetry. So you just mentioned flows. And so if I give you flow information, I say, this is source IP, this is a dest IP, this is a source port, this is a dest port. You being a geek are probably going to have an orgasm.
I call it a nerdgasm, but I get the point.
Sure. But most people will say, what was that? There's all this bunch of numbers. What do I do with it? And if you can say, okay, the source IP is actually this customer, and I need to use DHCP information to figure out who that IP was assigned to, and then use other information to say, oh, it's this customer. This dest IP goes over this path to this peering router and goes to this peer of mine. And the source port and the dest port will identify the applications that are talking to each other. Now, suddenly, I can say, wow, this is what is really happening in my network. But to do that, I have to take the flow information, DHCP information, IGP information, BGP information, and correlate these to make sense of what is happening.
And it's the ability to handle all of that in real time as well, because there's a constant sets of data that are coming through.
Right, right. As you get this real-time telemetry, which is streaming, you're going to collect a lot more data. And so can you make sense of that in real time? can you then use that to make useful decisions? And in the end, it's about making decisions and taking action.
Yeah, and the implication of self-driving is it's not a human being that's trying to digest that information. It's that software is analyzing that data that's flowing inbound from the network and can make sense of it in a way that is useful to us at an operational level.
Right, right. And actually, that leads back to the security imperative, where every time there's been a security breach in, you know, whether it's Yahoo or Target or whoever had these breaches happen to them, they have an indication that something is going on. But they have 10,000 other indications, and many of them are false positives. You don't know which one to chase down. And if you pick the wrong one and you spend some time chasing that down, you know, data is being exfiltrated as you're chasing the wrong indicator. So exactly what you said, if you have all this data going into a system that does the analytics and says, here are the five things you should be chasing. Forget the other 9,995. That's what you need.
So let me ask a question. How does Juniper bring that to market? How are you going to bring the telemetry to the customer?
So we start by putting these, what we call sensors, in our devices. So in the routers, in the switches, in the security devices. So in the ASICs, in the MX line, which has the Trio chipset, we actually allow people to, say, monitor the bandwidth of this interface or monitor the bandwidth of this LSP. And that data comes streaming from the ASIC to your collector. And as we go along, we're adding more sensors. So we're putting a sensor for the routing engine to measure the CPU and memory utilization. We're putting sensors in the line cards to measure the CPU and memory utilization of the line card CPU. Mm. We just keep adding sensors. And right. People have asked us for sensors for, you know, even the transponders that are connected to the interfaces.
Right. So that's in the devices themselves. And then in terms of interpreting that data. So now I've got all the data coming from the sensors. Are you bringing a product to market that will help me interpret that?
We have an open source project called NTI, Network Telemetry Interface. That allows people to essentially write their own collectors for all the streaming data and visualize it and display it the way they do. But we are also planning to come up with controllers of different kinds that will use this data in the pursuit of something else, like, you know, better service placement for your BNG customers or your VPN customers, or better analytics for determining how your LSP should move around in the network to be more efficient of the networking resources.
Because this is kind of new, this idea of a network device, a router or a switch, as a telemetry point. In the past, we've always put something else in the network, a device or a tap, and then then built a separate network to collect, to take the telemetry data and then to do something with it. So step one, device becomes a telemetry system or a telemetry node. It collects, has data capabilities in it, which is not something historically we've done. And then now we're talking about an emerging market around these telemetry collectors that we can do stuff with.
Absolutely. And right. And then, you know, as you said, you absorb this and do stuff with it. The simplest thing is to visualize, but we want to do much more than that.
Which leads us into a discussion around automation and declarative intent. So automation is, I think, something we've pretty much talked to death, which is using software to replace manual configuration at its simplest form, you know, pull APIs and to make the device do something that you want it to do. But I think what we really need to do is move past automation into the next generation, which is around declaring your intent.
Absolutely. And, you know, intent-based networking is all the buzz nowadays. And, you know, Chuck Robbins of Cisco says this will define networking for the next 30 years. The funny thing there is...
It's probably software-defined network for the next... Sorry, I'm joking.
Yes. Yeah. No, he said intent-based. Yeah. But the point is, we've been doing intent-based networking for the past 5 years. I mean, if you look at what Contrail does, you essentially say, you know, create these virtual networks, make sure this VM is part of this virtual network and not part of that one. Here are the policies between virtual networks. So you talk at a much higher level. And then the moment you create a VM, all the right things happen in terms of who that VM can talk to, what ACLs it has to go through to talk to some other VM in a different virtual network. So there's a certain amount of intent-based networking already implemented in Contrail. There's another product we have called NorthStar. So intent-based networking is really important. Again, going back to the analogy of self-driving cars, that self-driving car doesn't have a steering wheel or pedals, but it has a little display where you can say where you want to go. And that's your intent when it comes to self-driving cars.
I'm still not completely convinced that we've nailed down exactly what intent is, because the differences are subtle from person to person and perspective to perspective as we go around. But yes, I get what you're saying, Caridi, that you know, using the analogy of the car, if you're pointing in a specific direction, that's your intent, but you don't actually have to do the work of getting it there.
I sometimes think intent is like, you know, I want to go from London to New York. Do I use a car? Do I take a submarine? Do I take a cruise ship? Do I need to catch a plane? And the answer is, well, it depends. How much money have you got? How much time have you got? What's your personal preference? So you have to express those intents, and that decides. Now, 9 times out of 10, getting in a plane to go from London to New York is a good idea because it's fast. It's expensive, perhaps, compared to a nice – but a cruise ship would be a hell of a lot nicer experience, provided you've got plenty of spare time. And I think intent is like that. It's I want to express my intent around this network traffic. You know, it should. I need this much bandwidth with this much latency. I don't really care how I get from point A to point B. It could be a spaceship for all I care, well, as long as I meet the parameters.
So, Greg, I'm going to jump off of that and, Caridi, ask you a question, because one of the challenges I've thought about with intent that I think you can put some framework around is the complexity of a network and the number of ways in which you could do something. So how do you put constraints and boundaries around intent such that you have a predictable outcome that's not mired down by, you know, a lot of choices or by however a particular engineer might have chosen to assemble a particular network?
But just 1 second, let me go back to cars. Anti-lock brakes. You don't think about it. The UI looks just as for the manual brakes that you had before. But when you stamp on your brake, in an emergency situation, there's a lot of stuff happening under the covers, all kinds of measurement, you know, left wheel versus right wheel, and is the car sliding and stuff. And so to your point, absolutely, all that complexity should be hidden from the user, and the user should be given a UI that is so much easier to deal with. So intent is squishy, especially if you think human intent. Imagine that I were to give you intent formulated as the cost of this link, the cost of this network, the cost of this device, and also here's what I get for this peering, or here's what this user, this subscriber is paying me. And you start taking all that and saying, I have finite resources and I want to maximize my revenue, I want to maximize the satisfaction of my customers. You can get to where intent is almost like a linear programming problem. Here are the constraints, and here's the function I want to optimize. And then you say, go do it. You know, hit the button and say, just do it for me. So I think, you know, if as long as we think of intent as being this very squishy, fuzzy thing, we'll just keep talking around it. But if we start saying, I have an economic problem or an economic thing that I want to solve here, and that's where my intent is going to be around. And how you do it and where you place the LSP and what you do with this VPNs and this broadband customer, that's a detail that I will let the machine do, but this is what I want to have accomplished in my network.
And I think that mushiness around intent is also leads to confusion in marketing. It's very easy for marketing people to get a little overambitious around it and overdefine, or to embrace it when really they don't have it. And that's just the way of things. Please, you know, just smile as you go under, sort of thing. And the second part is that customers also hear it differently. So everybody who hears, you know, us talk about intent tends to hear something in the framework in which they operate or they live or their knowledge. And so you may hear intent. So I think there's many forms of mushy. That is, intent itself is mushy. Sharing the message around intent gets mushy, and then the people who hear it get mushy too. So there's a lot of confusion, and it's, you know, we've seen this years and years over the years. So don't, if you're in the audience, please don't get confused about that. I think the last part of the self-driving network, the five technology pillars that you laid out, Caridi, is machine learning. I mean, this is an emerging area of the market. How do you see that playing out?
You know, in every other industry, people have already started using machine learning or experimenting with machine learning for the last, you know, several years. I went to a machine learning conference last December, and there were people from Audi. Of course, they're there for self-driving cars. There are radiologists saying, can I use machine learning to figure out whether this X-ray means that the patient has a certain type of cancer or the bone is broken or whatever you do with X-rays. People are doing DNA sequencing. They're doing drug discovery. They're doing so many different things. And we're a little bit behind in networking. Fundamentally, where machine learning comes in is to take all this data that I'm getting from my real-time telemetry, to do the correlation, the multimodal views, to know what the intent of the network operator is, and then to produce the right kind of action through the automation infrastructure to make the network move in the direction that it should, to either for optimizing resources or to shut down a DDoS attack or whatever it is. So machine learning is a key, gluing all these things together.
And how's that going to emerge? Do you want to give us some insight around how machine learning is going to emerge in networking? Is it going to be, you know, you've got the ingest of all the telemetry data that we talked about and using your network devices as telemetry nodes in the system. And, I mean, keep in mind too here that I think we're also seeing vSwitches become telemetry nodes as well. So don't just think about this as hardware devices. There's also software switches like the Contrail vSwitch and so forth. Is that going to emerge as a, in terms of productizing, in terms of a software platform like Contrail, you're going to have machine learning in it? Or is it what we've seen much more of, I think, is machine learning is done in the cloud. The data is exported to some external resource, usually in somebody's cloud, and then it's munged, and then we come to some conclusions, and then those conclusions are then downloaded to people's networks. We see, so that if we see this pattern in the network, if we see the telemetry data matching this pattern, then we know a thing has happened. Is that the way it's going to emerge, or is it going to be something different in your view?
So I think it's actually both together. And the way a lot of people are thinking about machine learning is, you know, I'll take the standard example. I'll give you a million pictures and ask you, is this of a cat or not of a cat? And machine learning is really good at doing things like that. And so you feed these million pictures in and say, you know, this is a cat, this is not a cat, this is a cat, this is a cat, this is not a cat. And you have a lot of processing that you have to do, but you come up with a model, and then you give it a new picture, and in, you know, in microseconds, it can tell you that is a cat or that is not a cat. So basically, you have a lot of work to do at the front end to come up with what they call a model. And once you have the model, though, it's really quick to use the model to determine whether this new picture is a cat or not a cat. So if you were to say, here's the machine learning problem I want to solve in networking. For example, bandwidth prediction. So I take, you know, 6 months of data of bandwidth across my whole network, feed it through these massive computers in the cloud, come up with a model. I can then download those on the router or something very close to the device. And as they see the traffic, they'll say, yeah, this is what I expect. Oh, this is an anomalous traffic. Maybe it's too much. Maybe it's too little. Let me figure out why. So if you were to do it that way, you'd have a bunch of processing in the cloud, and then you'd have this sort of small model that you download to the device and say, do your thing. And so you could do that for bandwidth, you could do it for syslogs, so that on the device or near the device, maybe, you know, near a cluster of devices, you say, let me take all the syslogs and correlate them and say, this is the root cause. So I do root cause analysis using machine learning rather than a rule-based system. But you are going to have to do a bunch of work on a lot of data. This is why we all talk about big data in the cloud. And then you're going to come up with this model, and then you're going to bring that model near the device or in the device and say, now do your thing. that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think what you're saying is we're going to need to, there'll be some cloud processing for some applications, and the rules will then be downloaded closer to the device or in the device itself. And then the device itself may actually have the processing power to do its own machine learning, or a controller on site may do some localized machine learning according to its needs. And so one of everything, in effect, is a possible outcome.
Yes, yes.
Which is fine, right? Because at least we've defined three broad categories. And so people who are listening to this should be able to sit there and think about machine learning in the context of networking, and at least simplify down machine learning into three, you know, sort of broad groups. So when they evaluate products from Juniper or anybody, they should be able to say it should fit into one of these three buckets. And that's useful in terms of determining your forward strategy, I think.
Indeed.
It's very difficult to build networks and not know where you're going. So let's have a look at the safe driving journey and turn the conversation over to Nathan now. Nathan, one of the things that struck me is, and I want to take Caridi's metaphor about the car, and he's right when it breaks down, but in the early 19th century, when cars first emerged, everybody used to employ a chauffeur. And the term chauffeur literally means, is the French word for heater up. And the job of the chauffeur was to actually go out and heat the car engine up so that the diesel-powered cars could actually start, because the way diesel works is you have glow plugs to form the explosion. Once the engine's running, it's all fine. But the chauffeur was literally employed. You'd say to the driver, go and get the car ready. And he would go out and get the engine warmed up, heat the glow plugs by applying a battery to it, and then the engine could start and then they could drive off. I think the term chauffeur is very similar to what's happening in self-driving networks, is where we're going to do without the chauffeurs because they're going to become able to drive by a driver, and ultimately they're going to be able to drive themselves. Does that make sense? Is that a metaphor that works for you?
Yeah, I think it does, actually. It makes a lot of sense. So I think where we are today in network management, network automation, is more of certainly that human-driven aspect. You know, even a lot of people or a lot of companies that are well advanced down the automation road, it's still very much human-driven. Right, there's still a lot of playbooks being written, or a lot of scripts, or a lot of Python tools that they write, that ultimately they have a human operator sit down and enter in the variables and hit go. And then that thing goes and does some piece of automation for them. That's where we're at today, but we need to move beyond that, right, to get to the self-driving networks. And so we think that we sort of have it charted out how that needs to work. So from human-driven, ultimately to the next phase, which will be event-driven. And then once we get through the event-driven phase, that's where we'll arrive at machine-driven, and then ultimately self-driving.
So there's you think there's a fairly clear pathway as we go forward. Today's manual-driven, and then we're going to have event-driven. So we're going to, once the telemetry systems kick in, we're going to be able to react to, you know, known system, known attacks, or known data points in the stream, and then it starts switching up into machine-driven, and then cognitive or autonomous operation completely. So does that sound about right to you? I mean, once we've got that sort of self-driving journey laid out, so if I was a network architect at a site, I'd be thinking, okay, human-driven, event-driven, machine-driven. How do I go about seeing a pathway to execution? If I was writing a strategy today that looked forward into the next 5 years, how does Juniper help me with that, well, an event-driven infrastructure, and then later on the machine and cognitive?
You know, like I said, most people today, they have these human-driven scripts, these human-driven tools. But almost always, when you look at when they're employed or when they come about, it's almost always in a very linear fashion in response to some other thing that happens on the network, right? So when a link goes down, then you go run this playbook to collect diagnostics. When a device goes down, then you go run this set of Python tools. So what we can do then is actually start to codify that via some very straightforward logic with a model we call the if this, then that model. So if this thing happens, then go do that. Right. So it's very straightforward. We can just lay those things out and then say, take all these tools that we've been writing and we've been building, and now we just plug them into this event-driven model so that when this event happens, go run that tool automatically. So we sort of start to edge out where the human operator is needed just to kick those things off, because we know when they need to run and we know exactly what events need to take place to make that happen.
But that's... That's not something you just, you know, run the setup wizard as you're building your new network and then those things are going to happen, because different networks have different foibles and different things that you've got to be concerned about and react to. So, exactly. Okay, you're agreeing with me. So does that mean every environment, therefore, is going to be building some kind of a unique set of events that they're going to be responding to?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what automation is, right? I mean, that's why automation is a thing. That's why Juniper can't come sell you a product that will run your network. right? It's just not possible because every network is different and every business process is different. So let me just sort of back up a step and say what we really want to do is automate business processes, right? So a classic example is new device onboarding. When you bring up a new router or a new switch, there's a business process that you go through over and above just provisioning, right? Maybe you have to enter it into asset tracking system, maybe open a ticket to track the progress. You enter in, you know, IP address information, whatever it may be. All of those, it's a very linear sequence of events. And so we can break that down and say when this new device comes online, whether someone physically turns it on or it's a zero touch process, then that should generate an event that we need to capture somewhere. Now we can subscribe to that event and say, okay, what's the next thing that needs to happen in our business process for this particular organization, right? So maybe there's an API to your ticketing system so we can grab that information from the new device and say, hey, let's open a ticket saying here's the new device. And then, you know, let's run a compliance check. Let's load some new code. Let's put down a base config, you know, so on and so forth. So this will absolutely be modeled for every different customer, every different environment.
Yeah, okay. And talk about subscribing to events and so on. You're really talking about an architecture that's pluggable, that pub-sub interface where it gives you the ability, it gives you the framework, the skeleton upon which you can hang all of your business processes and have them flow through. But it's also kind of an interesting thought that, you know, we're not, it sounds like from what you're describing, you don't think we're going to get to this place where yeah, the network's this thing that our processes ride on top of, and we've automated it and so thoroughly that we don't really have to think about it anymore. It's still something that we're going to have to interact with, we're going to have to tweak and tailor, that there's no such thing as a network that's so cookie-cutter that it's a one-size-fits-all for every environment.
Nope, you're exactly right. That is exactly how it's going to work, and which is why, you know, we're all still going to have jobs over the next 10, 15, 20 years. is actually building out these intents and building out these business processes, right? Really? So, I was just going to say it's sort of the middle ground because, you know, all we're really doing is automating these very straightforward logical constructs of if this thing happens, then go do that thing, right? Once we've solved that problem, then we can start to look at solving the much more difficult problem that requires machine learning of if this thing happens and that other thing and we're in a maintenance window and, you know, Frank is off for the weekend, now what do we do? You know, you can't really pull that down into a nice logical construct. Right? That's where we're going to need machine learning to take over, and that's going to be the next step.
Well, how do we interact with well, everybody's got a multi-vendor network, right? So, you know, I've got, you know, maybe I've got a lot of Juniper routers and switches, but maybe I went to some other vendor for some other components. Does this sort of an approach allow me to integrate all of those third-party network components that I may have?
I hope so.
So that's the plan, is what you're saying, is that over time we will be able to integrate third parties into this, you know, self-driving network architecture.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what you're seeing from the open source community already. Is, you know, there's a lot of tools out there and a lot of things that people are using from like a DevOps perspective or from an automation perspective that tries to tackle a lot of these problems. So what we're doing inside Juniper is taking the best of breed of all of those things that's coming out of the community and trying to pull those together and say, okay, here's a platform that we can build that now we can start to hang these business process automations on top of.
All right, so how much of this is real today, Nathan? I mean, are any of these components you know, something that I could leverage, you know, at this point, at least to do like reactions to events, you know, if this, then that kind of stuff? Is there anything there today?
There is, actually. So great segue. We just released a solution or reference architecture that we call JEDI, which is the Juniper Event-Driven Infrastructure, which is a set of components, mostly open source components, that we've brought together to provide exactly that. So it's built on some things like SaltStack, Ansible, GitLab, you know, a few others, Logstash, Kibana, so on and so forth. So a lot of those best of breed type things that are out there to help solve these problems, bring them together and try to do this.
Okay, so can you give us some specific examples of that? Or, well, let's back up a second. So JEDI is a thing that you've productized, built on a lot of different open source components. You mentioned SaltStack, which we've talked about on this show before. That's got a lot of very robust capabilities along. I think you said Ansible too, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of networking folks are familiar with that for pushing playbooks, et cetera, and then all the other bits that you've laid on it. So is this a productized piece of software that I can load up from Juniper, or is it more like, hey, here's a set of guidelines on how to pull all these open source tools together to make a thing?
Well, it is not a product. It is more along a set of guidelines and a reference architecture that would be more than happy to come in with like professional services or some thing like that. To kind of stand it up in your network and kind of give you a bit of a kickstart or a bit of a jump start down the road of how, you know, ultimately you have to build this stuff yourself, right? It's your network. You know how to run it better than any vendor possibly could. So the absolute best that we could do is build a platform that allows you to do that with minimal sort of, a minimal bit of runway, if you will, right? So.
Okay, so then let's talk through it. If I worked with Juniper and mm-hmm. we built this thing, what am I going to be able to do with it? What are the big principles behind the product?
You know, like I said, it's business process automation, right? And it is moving us down the path towards that self-driving network. The way that we do that is via simple event-based automation. So theoretically, you know, you already have a set of tools that you're already using, whether those are Ansible playbooks or, you know, Python scripts or tools. What we want to do is then map those against what things happen in your network, and then we want to bring in some tools that allows us to see when those things happen, right? So that's where we need the telemetry tools like AppFormix, like OpenNTI, like some of the third-party stuff, like SolarWinds or whatever. We'll need to integrate with those so that now we have the vision into the network to see when these things happen that will generate what we call actionable intelligence, and then we want to take actions based on those.
So that sounds vaguely familiar to me because I've been through or been a victim of, as I like to say, various SAP and Oracle projects over the years. And really those app platforms, that's the way they work. They come out with sort of a blank thing and then you spend months defining each one of the steps in the system. And it's up to you as a user to say this software needs to operate this way and this is how we invoice, this is how we collect debts, and then they go off and configure the SAP and the Oracle. Is that my vision of the Juniper event-driven infrastructure? Is that what we're talking about there?
I would say sort of. To a certain point, right? So really, you probably already have a set of processes that your IT organization, your operations organization operates under, right? You have different MOPs or processes, procedures, what have you. We just want to map those to events and then map mm-hmm. the tools you're already using to those events. And then, obviously, there's some integration points with your ticketing systems, your telemetry systems, whatever legacy stuff you have in your network that's currently there. Right.
Yeah, well, I was going back to the example we talked about with asset management, where I've got a mm-hmm. device that comes up the network, it triggers an event. When if I want to report that into my asset management system, one of the many asset management systems that's out there, well, now I need to do some glue work to be able to pull on the APIs of something like a ServiceNow and say, here's my new device, raise a case to add this to the maintenance agreement, and an email is fired off to purchasing to say, new your maintenance contract update, all that sort of stuff. So this is the sort of this is almost sounds like a bit like a microservices view of networking operations.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. So we try to take some of the best practices and best principles that we've seen from like the software world mm-hmm. and then apply those to network management. So you're exactly right. And I think the glue that maybe we haven't mentioned yet that brings all this together is that concept of the event bus. So mm-hmm. once we do that glue for your asset tracking system, just once so that it can talk to the event bus. Now, everything else that's integrated on that event bus can also consume that API as well via standardized format. So that's really kind of where the magic comes in, as in this being able to subscribe to various events and then having that single, if you'll pardon the expression, we call it the automation backplane of your network, right? It's a single place to plug in all the tools and all the integrations, and then everything can consume everything else. And you get this layering effect where once your asset tracking system is integrated, now every time you write a 10-line Python script, that can now consume everything that's inside that asset tracking system, right? Without mm-hmm. having to know the details of that API of that asset tracking system. It just mm-hmm. fires an event that says, hey, add this whatever.
So equally the same thing holds true for my monitoring, my uptime monitoring, my bandwidth charting. If the systems mm-hmm. that do my, you know, create the time series database and put it on a chart on a screen, you know, or the red green monitoring that you've got, if it's got an API, you can suddenly say this device is now in the network, and you can probably even extend it to say it's connected to these devices. Please add it to my diagram that shows what my architecture of my network looks like as well.
Yep, that's exactly right. So one of the things that we like to demo is, you know, this new device turnup, because that is something that every operations organization on the planet does in some form or fashion, right? And you're going to have lots and lots of different systems where you need to add that thing. And it's generally, you know, a manual process. So it needs to be added to your NMS, to your telemetry system, to your asset tracking, you know, just to name a few. And if those all have APIs, then we can just, when we get the event that says there's a new device, we can just go populate those devices automatically. So now we start to see the reality of OPEX reduction, right? Because that is, you know, maybe 4 or 5 minutes out of your day that you now get back. And as an IT manager, you've got 40 or 50 employees all saving 4 or 5 minutes, you know, multiple times a day.
I can promise you that 4 to 5 minutes is I've never seen a new device added in the network in less than 4 to 5 days. Like by the time I go through the asset management and then the graphical monitoring and then the go into the help desk and get the software loaded with that is like days and days of pain right there. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So yep. Automating all that just sounds like glorious, glorious thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we can do today. And more importantly, it's just a stepping stone to where we want to ultimately get, where we can have some of these automated type decisions, a more complex decision trees, right? Because ultimately, if you have, you know, the best machine learning program in the world that's telling you what needs to happen, if you don't have the infrastructure in place so that it can actually go affect those changes, it doesn't do you a lot of good, right? So this is sort of the pots and pans, the blocking and tackling to get us there.
With the machine learning, one of the things that we've mentioned, and actually Caridi was talking about this earlier, you got to train that data set so that it's useful. When we talk about bringing machine learning into automating our business decisions, what does a set of training data actually look like? Do we have an answer to that as an industry yet?
We have some of it. So, for example, some data that you don't need labels, you know, training is, you just mentioned it, time series. So if I know what the bandwidth looks like and I have a detailed view of the bandwidth over the past 6 months, I can tell you when your bandwidth is anomalous. It's too much or too little. And then I can try to figure out why that happened. But then there's other things like syslogs. So I look at syslogs and then I have this brilliant network operator who's, you know, worked on this equipment for a long time. And he can right away tell you how, you know, what you should do next, where the debugging should happen. But now if you say, let me take his accumulated knowledge and use that as the labels and then say, this is the syslog, this is what that person did, this is the syslog, this is what that person did, that turns into label data that you could use. There's not a lot of it, but there is maybe enough of it.
I get what you're saying, though. I mean, it becomes... Well, this is an interesting problem for us as an industry, actually, because the decisions you might make on one network could be different on a different network. So it's not like you could normalize a set of data that would be good for everybody. You do have to do an individual site-by-site sort of analysis of inputs and then human decisions that were made, normalize that data, feed it into the machine learning engine to make it go.
Right. But here's what you can do, and it's difficult to do because, you know, usually... different enterprises and different service providers don't want the data shared. But if you could use the accumulated data from across multiple enterprises and multiple service providers, you could get a basic model, and then you say, okay, here's a model that I've trained across all of this data. Now, how do I specialize it for this particular enterprise or for this particular service provider? And then you don't have to do quite as much training because hopefully the basic model says, you know, I know how to recognize when OSPF went down. And then you say, okay, but in this network, you know, they use OSPF in this funky way and they have these virtual links. So, I have to do a little extra training, but now, I don't have to do, months of training. I can do maybe a few days and I'll be able to make decisions in this network.
And I think the interesting thing here is that it actually starts to realize that our networking equipment is the same for every customer. Every business is different, It's not the network that's different. It's the business that every person, every business runs differently, has different processes. Everybody's accounting system is different. The way you asset manage is different. That's what makes the network different. Not the hardware, not the protocols, not the routing engine. It's about the business process that we meet. And that's what makes the network or any IT infrastructure unique is the business, not the actual network itself, which is something I've been banging on about for a while. Do you agree with that, Caridi?
I agree with that. And it's also the hardest thing to deal with. Because, you know, you can deal with the protocols if the protocol is not doing what it needs. So we can tweak that and fix it. But you go to a company and say, hey, you know, your business process need tweaking. You're lucky if you know exactly where that
gold.
Is going.
Yeah, yes. Comedy gold right there. That's not going to, that's not how it works. You know, you sit down in front of the chief financial officer and say, I need you to start forward funding so I can pre-purchase my assets. So, you know, I don't want to have to get a budget and then, you know, I just want to have these things in stock. And he just falls over in a hissy fit. It's amusing to watch, you know.
Or you fall over when he lops your head off.
There's lots of interesting things about the way IT infrastructure is funded and the way the business processes handle it today. And this is a way to sort of, if you can automate a lot of it, it frees up your time. I mean, one of the things that you talked about in a recent presentation was the goal here is to actually free up people to do higher level work, to actually focus on service design, if you like. Well, not the goal, but the result of all this automation and all of this machine learning and this self-driving architecture is that you should, as a network professional, have more time to do meaningful work.
Right. And that's a really important part, but it also comes with sort of a prerequisite that here you are, this network geek, you know exactly how BGP works and you know how to set the policies on a Juniper router, on a Cisco router, on a Nokia router. And then someone says, you don't need to do that anymore. And you sort of, what do I do then? And so there is the good and the sort of, you know, the driver and where you can, how you can use it. Learn how the machine learning works. Learn how to tweak it. Or learn how to do the service design and don't worry about implementing that. And so, yes, you get to work at a higher level, but you also have to prepare yourself to work at a higher level.
I think that comes back to the chauffeur metaphor I came earlier. You know, the idea of having a chauffeur who literally heats up the engine. And today, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we saw the rise of cars became stable enough so they didn't need a chauffeur. But you had to take them to the mechanic to get them serviced every 6 months or 3 months. Cars used to need a lot of oil changes and stuff. And in today, in the 2010s, your car pretty much drives for a year before it needs to go back to the garage. And self-driving cars extend that, you know, even further. They're talking with electric cars that the service intervals get phenomenally long. Even the tires last longer because of the way the braking works. The tires last longer and the brakes don't need changing. That's kind of what we're seeing. Or how I anticipate self-driving networking to work out is you will be doing useful work, like going from point A to point B faster, more efficiently, intelligently than you have been before. It's not a loss, it's a gain.
It is a gain, but you know, you go back to what Nathan was saying. You have to understand how the automation backplane works. You have to understand a little bit of Python programming. You have to do all these things, and then you know, your 4 days or whatever it took to bring a new device into your network becomes, you know, 4 minutes and, you know, life is so much better. But if you didn't do that sort of work up front that says, let me step away from, you know, the details of how all this works and warming up the engine to, you know, typing in what I need, what my intent is, and let the system take care of it. And then figuring out how to express your intent better, figuring out how to put hints around your intent so that the machine can make a, you know.
Yeah. So you can get faster response to security breaches. You can say, if this link overloads, then shed traffic onto these links. Or, you know, this link is costing me a lot of money. Why don't you route around this link?
Exactly.
You know, all these sorts of things have suddenly become possible that today would, you know, once you've configured a path in BGP using your magic command line of, you know, hipster power, it's, you know, you really all you've done is say, this is the best path between this point and that point. Even traffic engineering at its finest is basically about manually defining a path that's going to be fixed or even have, you know, maybe some quasi-intelligent fallbacks, but that's it. It's not really automation at any level.
Right, right. And we have this thing called auto bandwidth, which basically says, if I see the traffic on this LSP increasing, maybe find a new path that has more bandwidth available. And that's maybe the wrong response, because it's a DDoS attack and you're opening the gates wider. It's like, no, don't do that. Yeah. So the intelligent auto bandwidth would say, okay, let's analyze the traffic and understand why it's, you know, getting bigger. And maybe I shut it down because it's a DDoS attack. Or maybe I do find a bigger path, you know, a path that can take more traffic. So we have to get to the next level. Mm-hmm. And you know, both the humans that are running the network that are sort of expressing the intent and giving the hints, as well as the algorithms behind that to make running the network much easier.
Yeah, I think you're all hinting at root causes. So instead of configuring the network according to what you think it is or what you imagine it might be, you're starting to get to root cause. You've got the telemetry data coming together to show you what's really happening in the network. You've got some interpretation engine telling you what's happening over time. And then you've got some assistance in the interfaces, you know, Salt Stack or the JEDI interfaces or the OpenNTI to help you go click and something just happens at speed. You don't have to spend days raising a change request so you can SSH into a device after it's been validated to react to an issue. It's really breaking it down into fundamentals.
Absolutely.
So, Caridi, I want to talk a little bit more about security. Now, security is an issue great to my heart. I believe that ultimately for most IT security functions, the network is the first and best point of defense. And this sounds to me like, if we get these sorts of things going, all of a sudden security is going to become easier or better.
Well, certainly easier and hopefully better. But one of the things you have to realize is, imagine that you've got this walled city and you've got these humans at the gate, you know, holding their spears in full armor. And the things that are attacking them are not other humans, they're these bots. And these bots are sneaking by them, going through the walls, and you don't even see them. A fight of humans versus bots, the humans are going to lose. And so you almost need the good guy bot fighting the bad guy bot. And by that, I mean you have all these analytics that says what is normal in the network in terms of bandwidth, in terms of whatever, and then what's abnormal and how do I detect it? How do I understand why it's changed? Is it everyone downloading Beyonce's latest album, or is it you know, a DDoS attack, and then have automated response to that? So if you think about security in the next generation, it cannot be humans writing ACLs as fast as they can type. It has to be something better.
Mm. So this self-securing network has to be the way it's going forward. We can't keep manually responding because it's just not going to be able to do it fast enough. And I think the thing we aren't talking about here is human inaccuracies. Your ability to type stuff at the CLI is highly inaccurate compared to what a computer can do using an API.
Right. And your ability to analyze all these different signals coming in and saying, okay, here's what I got to focus on. So since we're in the mode of redefining the SDN acronym, I call this the self-defending network.
You're going to upset people everywhere by keep defining SDN to be...
That's my goal.
I like it. And I think this is really important because what we're also seeing is a lot of this self-defense stuff is based around including the firewalls or the security tools that we have, the security products, and you know, whether it's an IDS or a content inspection engine or whatever. All of those things come into... are able to be configured as part of the same system. So there's no reason why your JEDI interface can't start configuring your, you know, vendor X firewall as well as part of the network configuration. You don't have to start thinking of these things as isolated silos. They should all be configured as part of the same thing.
Absolutely. I'm sure Nathan would agree with that.
Yeah, so, you know, what we really need is when we talk about the self-driving network or the network automation platform that enables all these things, one point that I like to bring up is, you know, we need something that allows you to automate these business processes across IT organizational boundaries. So, you know, currently we have maybe your server team, your network team, security team, all working at cross purposes, are all doing their own thing with their own tool sets, their own scripts, and so on and so forth. But really, a lot of these things, especially when it comes to like, you know, self defending networks or a new device onboarding, what have you. These are processes that cross those boundaries. So when we think of, what's automation look like 2, 3, 5 years down the road, it has to include a way that all of those teams kind of communicate and work in the same sort of environment, which is kind of how we came up with this, automation backplane sort of concept.
Well, I think we've just about hit all the topics we wanted to cover in today's show with Juniper Networks, talking about self-driving networks. Thanks to Juniper Networks for sponsoring this show. Why don't we first go around the table and get how you can find people. Caridi, are you social? Are you on the internet? Can people find you somewhere?
Mostly by email, Skype, of course. Yes. I have a Twitter account that I have sent 3 tweets on in 3 years.
So let's just say that Caridi is available via the usual channels. Talk to your sales rep.
Or LinkedIn. LinkedIn does work.
And Nathan, what about yourself?
Fairly active on Twitter, so find me, follow me, send me a message, and let's talk.
Nathan, is there any way that people can track down Jedi, give that a spin, something like that?
Well, so we've just begun the process of publishing more information about that out on the web and various places. But for now, just contact your sales rep. They will be able to get you in touch with the right people inside the various organizations inside Juniper that can bring it to you and show you and set it up in your network.
That sounds interesting. I must admit I hadn't thought to look at it. I've added some links to the Juniper OpenNTI that we touched on, and there's a bunch of other links in the show notes associated with today's talk. So if you're interested in finding out more about the Juniper self-driving network and to get some hints about how programmability works and how Juniper approaches automation, there's a bunch of links in the show note on the website at Packet Pushers. And you can also follow Twitter, Juniper. You could also follow Twitter as @JuniperNetworks. Again, thanks to Juniper for sponsoring the show. Sponsors help us to bring you this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blogs at packetpushers.net. Follow us on the Twitter as @PacketPushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on the Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.